welcome to another episode of Mandatory Music and CD, the show where three friends get together and reminisce about the music that shaped our lives. I'm one of your regular co-hosts, Max Byrne, and as ever, we are joined by these two princes of the universe. First up, probably the only man in Florida who has never lost his head, it is, of course, Tony Farina. Tony, how are you, sir?
I'm excellent. I'm excited about this. I'm so glad you picked it because you and I have been talking Highlander on and off our whole since we've known each other for years and years. You are the person who probably loves Highlander more than me. I doff my severed head to you, Max Byrne. So I'm thrilled that you picked this. I'm excited.
Oh, me too. It's going to be good. And also, of course, we have with us the man who's always known that pain is just that little bit close to pleasure. It is, of course, Mr. Dave Horrocks. Dave, how are you, sir?
There can be only one. I just thought I'll throw it in there right away, so get that impression. I'm very good, thank you. I'm delighted to speak about this album and chat to you guys again about it. It's one that I hadn't realized, I hadn't really listened to end to end. So it was a bit of a surprise to me to go through it this time, so can't wait to speak about it.
Excellent. Well, I think the guys talking Highlander has probably given away what the actual album is we're going to discuss this week. And I'll just quickly as well, because you two have both done your Conor McLeod impressions, I'll just throw mine into the ring as well. There can be only one. So there you go.
I think you could even say Ramirez the right way. You could even say like the way that he says it, because you really hit the with your one very well. That was excellent.
You Spanish peacock.
There it is.
Like that.
Yeah. Oh, that is very good. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah. Or if I had the Clancy Brown voice, you know, I could go Ramirez or something. Yeah. Like that. I can't quite do it. Not butch enough to be Kurgan, sadly. But anyway, yes.
Phil definitely is butch.
Yeah, he is, isn't he? Jesus wept. More of him later, because one of these songs is very Kurgan-y, so we'll get to that. But of course, yes, the album we're doing is the 1986 classic or not classic, that's up for debate, A Kind of Magic by Queen, released in June of 1986, recorded from September 85 to April 86 in various studios in Germany, Switzerland and the UK. It was a smash hit in the UK. The album went straight in at number one. Queen were probably at the height of the popularity in 86, post Live Aid in 85. Not a huge hit in the States. It only went to 46 in the Billboard charts. But as Brian May likes to say in interviews, he feels like they lost America after the I Want to Break Free video and the backlash of them all dragging up in that. And it's quite telling as well that the tour that they did, which was the last Queen tour with Freddie, of course, and John, was only in Europe. It was a huge tour, sold out stadiums wherever you turn, but they didn't go to America with it. I think they sort of said they didn't want to go back on to tour America until they had another hit album. But of course, circumstances dictated that never happened. So talking about this album then, obviously, as we do in this show, we talk about, you know, before we talk about the tracks, talk about our history with the album per se. So I'll start with you, Tony. Do you have any history or any connection to A Kind of Magic?
Well, I mean, obviously the Highlander stuff, you know, when pre-internet, you didn't really reel. And again, this didn't do well in America. And in 86, you know, I was only 13. So I didn't have a car. I couldn't get to anywhere. I'm from a little nowhere town. So I couldn't get to this. I couldn't get my hands on this. So to me, it was just, it wasn't until later that I really realized it was called A Kind of Magic. I was like trying to find the Highlander soundtrack, which didn't exist. My favorite Queen album is The Game. Will always, and I'm a big Queen fan because I'm a human being, and so therefore I like Queen. And so everybody, Queen is one of those bands that even if you don't like Queen, you like a Queen song. I don't know anybody in the world. I mean, it's like you're like actively being a dick. You're like, ah, Queen. There's not one good Queen song. Fib. That's a fib. So no, it wasn't this album. I didn't come to till later just because I didn't get my hands on it. But of course, because of the Highlander, you know, soundtrack, which I kind of pieced together, you know, myself, old school, playing music off the TV and recording it. You know, the New York, New York isn't on here, which I didn't know until later that Freddie had to be like coerced into doing that. He didn't even want to. So that was disappointing. But other than that, like, I'm thrilled that it exists. I have lots to say. And maybe I will burn out instead of fade away. We'll find out. So that is that's where I'm at.
Excellent stuff. Excellent stuff. And what about you, Dave?
So I had no idea that this was sort of a Highlander album. I mean, it's very weird. So the fact that you've got lots of songs from this, which are direct, you know, almost written for the movie. But then in Highlander, you also have Hammer to Fall, which obviously isn't on this album. It's just a little bit confusing. And like yourself, Tony, I'm thinking, why not just have a Highlander album? You know, it just strikes me a bit odd. And I think we were talking in the Discord, weren't we? And One Vision, I think, is on Iron Eagle or something like that, isn't it? Mm, but yes, yeah. I think this is the first time I've listened to the whole thing. You know, so I knew the hits, obviously. And the thing is, Queen must love selling their songs to TV commercials, because the problem is, I just can't help but listen to these and just think of a TV advert, like One Vision. Actually, there's two things that come up in my head. So One Vision, I'm sure it must have been a Color Vision advert, which was like an old TV type, might have even been a rental company, like, you know, Radio Rentals, Rumbelows, all these kind of companies that have gone out of business now. But it's just like an advert theme tune. But the other memory it springs up, so a good friend of mine who I didn't really know very well at the time, but he was coming in with an acquisition of another company. So two companies, one was acquiring another one, but they were sort of equal size. And, you know, with acquisitions, it's difficult, you know, people, different organizational cultures and whatever. And he was trying to just make sure and get everyone behind, you know, this One Vision. And so as we all walked into the conference room, he's got that playing, you know, One Vision, and it is the most David Brent thing I think I've ever experienced in real life. And for that, I still rib him about it now, because it is the cringiest thing that ever was or ever will be, I think. But I it was quite funny as well. So nothing really with the album itself, but obviously you're surrounded by Queen. I think I consume Queen more in the hits, greatest hits type albums. So I haven't listened to many of the albums just on their own. So it'll be interesting to listen to a few more. But yeah, that's me.
Great stuff. I think, well, for me, I mean, Queen, as far as I'm concerned, in the UK, Queen are more ubiquitous, I think, in terms of popular culture and the songs being ingrained in people's minds, and even the Beatles, I think, when you think about it, just in terms of the sheer amount of huge hits the band have had that everybody knows and everybody recognizes. And like you said, Dave, it is because the music is used in literally everything. I think they just have a default setting when an offer comes into management. The default setting is yes.
Deacon still gets paid because he's not in the band anymore. Deacon's probably like, yes, yes. Yes, I don't have to tour. Yes, I'm sure that's part of it, you know.
Well, they do say, like John Deacon, he retired from the business and from all public life at the end of the 90s. But they when you read interviews with Brian and Roger now, they say that John is still very much part of the Queen organization and very much has his eye on the finances of the band even now. So I think it is just yes, 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 yes. I think when Freddie died, it's famous in documentary that when he, in his will, he left the control of all his music to Queen's manager, Jim Beach. And he said, you can do whatever you want with my music, whatever you want, just don't let me be boring. And I think he's taken it like to the nth degree. Queen's, well, that's a manager's job, isn't it, to make money for their artist, I suppose, and to keep them out there. So I think he's done his job to the nth degree, certainly in terms of the amount of money they must earn now a year, the four of them, including Freddie's estate, is just, I can't even contemplate. Their music is just everywhere. But back to this album, I mean, we had it on cassette, for those who are old enough to remember cassettes, in the house. And I just remember reading it and reading the lyrics. And like I said, at this time, Queen were just, they were the biggest thing going in the UK. They were just enormous. Freddie was at his most iconic in 86. You know, people think about him on that tour and Wembley Stadium with the yellow tunic jacket on, giving it loads. That's what people who aren't, even if you're not a Queen fan, if you asked to think about Queen and Freddie Mercury, that's probably what you'd think about. So, yeah, it was just always there. And like you guys say, it's part of Highlander. So anything that's part of Highlander is always going to be a winner for me. So that's that.
As big, sorry to cut across you there, Max, but as big as Live Aid was, and it was huge, and you had all of the biggest stars, you know, in Wembley in the UK, you had the US stuff as well.
Philly, yeah.
But, I mean, nothing, in terms of stuff that gets replayed, it's always Queen, isn't it? It's always Freddie, you know, marching around in his white wife beater top. Yeah. So I can't think of any other really iconic bands that get that particular gig shown again and again.
Yeah, it is. It's just ubiquitous, isn't it? There's no band that have as big a profile. I don't know what that's like in America, Tony, whether they're, you know, I know they're obviously massive everywhere, but do they have that same kind of profile even now in America?
Queen is one of those big, they still tour with the dude from American Idol, whose name is
Adam Lambert. Yeah.
Adam Lambert.
Yeah.
And I've not seen them. You know, my sister saw them not that long ago, and, you know, Brian's still out there shredding. And I know people who go to see them. You know, they tour nonstop and they play big stadiums. And so the people who are Queen fans are Queen fans. The thing is because they are in a lot of things, because they're in movies that people know. You know, obviously they were famously in Wayne's World, but you know, We Are the Champions is everywhere. Everybody knows that song. So there's enough people who like become Queen fans, and I like both like my two, and then Rachel, my two birth kids. Love Queen, and Rachel in particular, just because Rachel's a big Bowie fan. So there's that Bowie Queen crossover, obviously, with Under Pressure. And of course, you know, obviously the Vanilla Ice kerfuffle that happened in America in the 90s with that song too. So they are still pretty well known. They're not, I don't know anybody who does it. I did a book club not that long ago, and they were talking about the soundtrack, the music in my books, and somebody's like, I had to look up those bands because I thought you were making them up. I didn't think they were, some of those bands were real. And I was like, Queen? And this was a woman in her 70s. She's like, oh no, I know Queen. So it doesn't matter wherever you go, and people are like, I'm not sure about that, are you making up that band? If I say Queen, they all know. So it's, they're just there. They're just kind of, they're like, if you say the Rolling Stones, if you say the Beatles, if you say the Beach Boys, they're a band that everybody in America knows. Now, whether or not everybody in America loves the way that, you know, like you do, Max, or like, again, I had the game on 8-track. Wow. And if those of you who ever had 8-tracks, it was really only 4 tracks, not 8, but which I never really understood the concept. But when you had an 8-track, it would fade out in the middle of the song and then click to the next song, like if it didn't fit in. So that was actually how I knew some Queen songs. Like I was always expecting a fade out because I wore the fucking game out. I love the game. I just love that album so much. So anyway, Queen fans love Queen. That's my thing. But yes, I don't know anybody who doesn't know who they are.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're just so ingrained in everyone's consciousness. There's no getting away from it.
Yep.
But nevertheless, here we are, this wonderful album, 9 songs, 6 of which are in Highlander, only 3 aren't. The 3 in question being One Vision, Pain Is So Close to Pleasure, and Friends Will Be Friends. So let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start, as Maria Von Trapp once said. So this is the opening track, Dave said at the start, this isn't the Highlander song. This is actually was featured in the film Iron Eagle, and actually recorded a year before the bulk of this album, but included on it all the same. And I think it's all the better for it. This is, of course, One Vision. And there we go with that ominous intro. This is the only song on the album that is credited to all 4 members as well, which is very, very rare with Queen, actually. They always had sort of one person or 2 people as credited as songwriters on songs. But then after this album, the 2 that they did after this, the final 2 after Freddie's diagnosis, everything was credited to all four members because he thought, fuck it, life's too short and we need to work here and get as much done as we can in the last years. So everything was credited to all four members. But this obviously was the only, as far as I'm aware, the only example of it. So One Vision. Tony, talk to me. What do you think about One Vision?
Well, I do. There's the Yamaha DX7 features heavily on this album. This is the height of, like, you know, music I love, which is like, you know, Duran Duran, Depeche Mode. This is the height of kind of new wave, right? Yeah. Queen is one of those bands that bridged it for me. Like, they're, I mean, you heard that. You heard We Waited for Brian May to fucking kick your teeth in with his searing guitar, but he does it on the back of that. And you actually see what I love about One Vision is I feel like, Van Halen heard One Vision and were like, God damn it. We need more keyboards. That's what honestly I feel, because, you know, the next couple of albums, this is after Hagar joined. And so all of a sudden there's a lot more keyboards in the band. And I truly credit it to this song. I like it. I don't think it's as far as openers go, we've talked about album openers. It is not Hotel California. It's not Welcome to the Fucking Jungle, but it is a really good, solid opener. You can tell that the whole band is working their ass off. It's fun. It's not my favorite song on the album, but it's definitely fun. I would have not started with it, but I also understand why they did. I think Brian May, Freddie is such a character, and he's, you know, in his own creation, that's obviously intentional, is that you forget what a great band they are. Sometimes you forget that Deacon, Taylor, and May are such amazing musicians. And this song really allows you to sit with them before Freddie comes in. So I think that's real smart. So I think it's written. Dave, you always say it's like the band noodling around and then they're like, let's do this. That's what this feels like. It's just like the three of them are sitting around doing stuff. And then Freddie gets to come in over the top of them and, you know, Freddie it up. So I really like it. I think it's a fun way to start. It literally lets you know what you're about to get. It almost works a little bit like a precursor to the schizophrenic nature a bit of this record.
Great stuff. Dave, what do you reckon to One Vision?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to love this song, isn't it? I do feel like I've heard it in the advert context so many times. I'm trying to just separate that, Colour Vision advert or whatever it was from just listening to the song. And I think that there must be a radio edit because this is definitely a little bit longer, certainly on the intro. It's some really interesting effects that come in at the beginning, you know, with the sound. It almost sounds like a horror movie, you know, where you have like demons in the background or something and they're all kind of muffled and stuff. But I do like the way you've got that one synth, which is just almost like a one note, you know, it's like do-lo-lo, and it's all going through. And then you've got the bass drum, you know, dum, 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 dum. And then everything comes in and then very quietly you get the da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and everything kind of builds up. And then you could just see, you know, if this was live, you know, Brian May coming out with a big, you know, big swing of the guitar, that opening riff, that's a proper power rock riff, isn't it? And then I can sort of see Freddie in his vest, you know, pumping his chest out, strutting across the stage. It just gives me so much joy to listen to. The advert stuff, I'm trying to shake that off, but I think it's a fantastic track, and it has been played so many times over lots and lots of different things, but it is a great track. I think it's a decent way to start off, and I do think sometimes, you know, you want to start off with a bang, but I do like where you just introduce one instrument at a time, and then everything kind of layers on the top, and then, like I say, a nice big power rock riff there.
Good stuff. Yeah, I can't argue with that. I mean, I do like One Vision. I think the lyrics, although the message is good and the message is, you know, admirable, it's delivered in such a fucking ham-fisted way. You know, Queen don't do earnest. They don't really do subtlety much either. But, you know, I get the lyrics and they're supposed to be sort of related to Martin Luther King and what have you. But it's done in such a over the top way that it does come across as a little bit panto. But I do love this song. I mean, you've got to be fucking dead inside, I think, to not like it. It's of course it's dated. It's very, very 80s. But it is great. It's a straight ahead rocker. Good set opener. They opened the show with this on the tour. That intro works as like an intro tape to build and build and build before, you know, they run onto the stage with the opening stuff. Just a good pop rock classic song, isn't it? You know, it's quite a simple riff and a consistent beat all the way through. Very stop start riff, and then there's a gap, and so on. I think it's great, and the production's fantastic on as well. The whole album, it sounds big, it sounds massive. The production is really, really good on this album, but it's very much a time capsule of 1986. You know, three nearing middle-aged rockers in 86. But yeah, it is. It's a great song as one of the three non-Highlander songs in it. I think this is the best of the three. Not that it's off against the stiffest of competition, which we'll get to. But yeah, I think as an album opener, it's very, very solid stuff. And you know, you can't help but nod your head to it and get into it. Okay, so that's the first one, One Vision. The second one, a shorter song at 4 minutes and 24, written by the drummer, Roger Taylor. This is the title track of the album. It is, of course, A Kind of Magic.
It's a kind of magic.
There you go. Check out those clicks. Wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. Very, very Highlander influence. Lots of Highlander references in this song. A kind of magic. Is it a kind of magic or is it a kind of something else? Dave, what do you say to this one?
I think this is a little bit like with One Vision, where I've just heard it so many times. And actually, I've heard it many more times on different adverts and plugs for shows and stuff than I have on Highlander. So, you know, when you hear something, like if you hear Flash or something like that, well, it's obviously, thank you for the, I actually heard.
How do you not fist pump when you did Flash?
Yeah,
oh, yeah, so, how do you not
after I
do
said
that
Flash,
every time? Yeah.
Tony punched in the air and I heard in my head, it went, ah, dun, dun, savior of the universe. Okay. So, but you think of the movie straight away. I mean, it is the title of the song as well, but so for me, I guess what I'm trying to say is this doesn't make me think of Highlander just because I've seen it in so many other different contexts. And I think I like Queen a little bit more raw and authentic and rocky. You know, I like the kind of earlier 80s and the 70s stuff, you know, where there's a bit less kind of synth, you know, and this is, I feel like, you know, Freddie is sort of singing within himself. I mean, which is better than 99% of all of the singers who have ever lived or ever will live. But, you know, for him, he doesn't really have to exert himself at all. So it's just a nice song, you know, and I don't particularly think it, I'll never fast forward it. You know, it's not a song that I've like, oh God, it's this one, and I'll never skip it. So I do like it. I don't want to sound like I'm down on it, but I've just heard it so many times. And like I say, in so many different contexts, it's just one of those songs that feels like it's always been there. So for me, I'd have been 10 in 86. And in terms of music, I mean, you do remember a bit of music before that, but only bits, you know. You don't start to associate music with bands, I don't think, until around that age. And so, yeah, it's above middle of the road for me, but not one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's fair enough. What do you reckon, Tony?
I hear that. I hear all that. I just love it so much because I am convinced, and I said this recently to Heath, I'm convinced Queen made the Highlander movie better. It's kind of like John, like Queen made Highlander good in the way that John Williams made Star Wars good. Like, I feel like Queen added to the mythology of the Highlander universe by making such an amazing fucking album that the Highlander mythos carried on. It got sequels, it got a series, all because of the mythology that Queen made up that isn't in the movie. Like, you think, like you said it, Dave, you're like, it's all over the movie, but it's a kind of magic. That scene was added on later. The Connor going and rescuing little Rachel from the Nazis, that wasn't the original cut. Like, they paid for that themselves and went and like guerrilla shot that scene. And that, so it, It's a Kind of Magic part was added on. And so whether the myth, whether it's true that it was because they heard this song and they wanted to squeeze that in, or the other way around, that that scene was made and that's where it came from. But like, I think, so I because again, I love the movie so much, and the way that that scene is so good to me, the Connor saving little Rachel from the Nazis, I love it. So I can't dissociate the song from that scene in the movie, which is like, you know, Lambert just cheesing it up. Hey, it's a, and then of course he drops it again at the end when he goes to fight Kurgan. It's a Kind of Magic. And, you know, so it's just got a sauce. I like this. Everything you said is true, Dave, but I can't separate it. I rate it higher because its importance to the movie and to the Rachel Connor relationship. I can't get away from it.
I don't know if we're going to get time to speak about it. Maybe today, maybe later. We need to talk about that relationship between him and Rachel, because it's fucking weird. Watching it this time, I'm like, that's a bit wrong. Some of the dialogue between those two, you know.
I know people read it that way. I don't. I always read it as he's her dad. I never read it. Never read it that they got grabby. Maybe she fell in love with him, but that's how I always read it. But I know some people do. You're not wrong.
I can't remember what it was. There was just some dialogue which was just a little bit saucy, and I thought, hang about.
those Highlanders, they don't know how to keep it in their kilts. That's for sure. Yeah. We learned from the series in particular. But anyway, so that's me. I do love it. I think it's beautiful. I do. I get what you're saying. This is a controlled Freddie Mercury's voice in this, which later we'll see him let loose. But it's still, it's a lot of fun. I feel like they're having a lot of fun. The finger snaps are just a joy. So, Max?
I don't dislike A Kind of Magic. It's one of those totally inoffensive, totally massive songs. It is everywhere. You can't get away from it in this country. It is everywhere. It's overplayed. It's used in commercials, and it's total middle of the road, safe kind of stuff. It's not, it isn't Queen at their best, but it's still better than a lot of bands' best efforts. I like the way the song's sort of driven by that bass line. I mean, John Deacon is so underrated as a bass player, you know, underrated as a songwriter, underrated as a musician, just top notch the way he could construct a bass line, just so effortless and so brilliant. It's total mid-80s dad rock. Again, there's no getting away from it. There's little bits I like. I love this little guitar run towards the end where he goes it's really cool. It's quite understated but yet quite technical as well, which I think sums up Brian May in some ways. And yeah, I think again, it's hard not to like it. It really is hard not to like it, but I don't love it. But again, if it comes on, I'll listen to it. But it's never going to be in my top 10 or 20 Queen songs. But still, you know, nothing wrong with it per se. So moving on from that, we go to an interesting song next, written by the aforementioned Mr. Deacon at 4 minutes and 27 seconds. This is One Year of Love. And for all you Highlander fans, this is played in the bar when Brenda and Connor first cross paths and he makes some comment about her. Yes, One Year of Love. Do you love this one, Tony?
Well, I sent you guys a message the other day. I'm like, do I like One Year of Love now? I don't. Now, here's the thing. I felt like I was coming to the other end. As we always say, we get through the Stockholm Syndrome with the albums over a month. And because this is a short one, there's only 9 songs. And I love Queen, so it's not like I don't listen to a lot of these songs over and over. I don't hate this song. I'm going to say this right now. There's not one Queen song that I dislike, that I think is bad. This is not... But I, because they're Queen. But my problem with the song after listening, Brian May is not in it at all. It's a saxophone. And I'm not, again, anti-saxophone, but I just think my problem with this song is, I know there's a version of it out there where Brian played and then Deacon, you know, they ended up taking it out. I don't like it for that reason. I feel like there's nothing wrong with having guitar in a ballad. I think Freddie sounds great. I think it works for the movie, all of that. It just, it's to me, it is, It is the least Queen song. There's a couple of from a few other albums. You're like, wow. But yeah, so it is my least favorite on this record, which I know that I'm going to put that on. I know each of you have a different one. So that is where I stand. It's a song.
Well, I can't sum it up better than that. It certainly is a song. I'll give you that, Tony. Dave, what do you think?
I quite like it. However, like you said, in terms of being a time capsule, it is so mid-80s, isn't it? And the amount of synth, you're just drowning in synth. And it's like, it needs to be stripped right back. And again, part of it is the production of the time. But if you were to play like a really, you know, stripped down version of this with piano, you know, instead of a synth, and you had Brian May on guitar instead of the saxophone. I mean, for the type of movie it is, for me, this would slightly different production. This would fit quite well in, say, Lethal Weapon as well. This is your classic kind of, you know, movie song, isn't it? You know, when you want to have a bit of on-screen chemistry between, it wasn't Rachel, what was the other lady's name?
Brenda Wyatt,
and a stalker in the bar.
100%. He's like,
he was so fucking stalky.
Do you ever go to Madison Square Garden? You're like, what the fuck, dude? What are you? Come on, yeah.
Police. Yeah, he was 100% stalking her. That right there, creepy as fuck. That scene was, but we've already reviewed this one, but I kind of want to go back and do it again. I picked up on so many more things this time. But yeah, I kind of feel like I can see why you're saying it's not Queen, and it is a bit stock, isn't it? Like I say, I think it needs to be a bit more bluesy, you know, and it's just they've really ramped up the 80s-ometer on it. So, I do like, you know, it's Freddie on it, isn't it? So you've got to like it on some part of the scale.
Right. So, yeah. There's no such thing as if Freddie Mercury's singing it, there's no such thing as a bad Queen song, because you get Freddie Mercury singing, which, again, like you said, that's him stubbing his toe and saying, fuckity fuck, probably sounds delightful.
Yeah. So yeah, no, I think I definitely like it a bit more than you. Definitely not the worst one on the album.
I agree, it's not the worst song on the album. We'll get to what I think's the worst song on the album. I agree what you guys have said. Freddie Mercury's vocals on this song are huge, and it elevates what is potentially a very dull song into something a little bit more. But having that sax solo is such an 80s thing. That was such a thing. Incidentally, a bit of trivia for you. The guy who played the sax on it is a guy called Steve Gregory, and he played the saxophone on Careless Whisper by George Michael.
What?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow. That saxophone fits perfectly. That's a perfect song. Yes. Wow, that's amazing.
So there you go. He must have been quite the session player in the 80s. If you wanted some sax on your song, give old Steve Gregory give him a call. He'll come down and lay down some sax for you.
It's a different version of laying down sax than our friend from Lost Boys.
Yeah. It must have been. Every time there was a sax, it was either Timmy Capello or Steve Gregory. Yeah. But I bet Timmy was probably too butch for Freddie, wasn't he? He probably didn't like the big butch, muscly boys, so he went with Steve. Well, yeah, he probably did.
He'd have been all right with that, yeah.
Yeah. He probably would, to be fair. Yeah. Probably took on all comers. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a pleasant listen. It sounds like a kind of song that should be played in like some smoky cabaret room or something like this by some guy with an open shirt and an undone bow tie, you know. And I quite like the string arrangement towards the end. That's quite luscious. But other than that, it's again, it's not a song. If someone said, "Oh, let's put some Queen on," I'm going to go, "Yeah, let's put One Year of Love on." Yes, let's do that. No chance. But you know, I've heard a lot worse, and the singing is just, I mean, on this whole album, Freddie's voice is just phenomenal. I mean, he, like you said, Dave, better than any other singer. I think, in my opinion, it's all about opinions anyway, but in my mind, he's the greatest to ever do it and has ever done it. I don't think there was anyone who's ever been better than Freddie, both as a singer and a showman.
Yeah, I'm with you. in terms of vocalist and just that front man, that stage presence, I can't think of anyone who gets close to him.
No, you know, the only person, and this is the only person who comes close to me, and his is Fred Schneider from the B-52s. He's classically trained to sing opera, so he can do a lot that Freddie does. His voice isn't as big, and because Kate, the women, the Kate and of course her name's eluding me right now, Cindy, they're up there, you know, stealing the show from Fred. So he just kind of stands there, also called Fred. But I feel like he's the only person who's close to trying to front a band. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing like Freddie. There's nothing like it, and it's a spectacle. Everything he does, he knows exactly what he's doing. I know Steve was actually at the live. Our friend Steve-O was actually at Live Aid. He was at that show.
Amazing.
I know. I never did get to see Freddie play live. Like, as you said, they quit coming to America, and I was 13 when this album came out, so I never did. It would have been a joy. I just can't imagine what that was like.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I know Steve saw him on this tour as well, the Magic Tour in 86 at Wembley Stadium. So he saw him at Live Aid in 85 and a year later doing their own, this massive headline tour as well. But yeah, it would have, I mean, I was 7 in 86, you know, so no chance. I saw Queen and Paul Rodgers, if that counts, in 2008, I think it was.
Nice.
When they had a few years with Paul Rodgers from Free/Bad Company before they transitioned to Adam Lambert. Yeah, they did a couple of tours with him and an album actually of original material called The Cosmos Rocks, which really didn't rock. It was shite.
Was that when Brian was finishing his doctorate? Is that why it's called The Cosmos Rocks? Because Dr. May is like all in his head. He's like, this is the song we're going to write. It's all.
Well, yeah, I think he should have stayed in the Cosmos when they were doing the sessions for that album. But the show was brilliant. You know, it was a huge, you know, it was a 2.5 hour show. All the hits of Queen, plus a few hits of the Free and Bad Company stuff as well. And Paul Rodgers is a legend in his own right, but he wasn't quite the right fit to sing Queen music, you know. But it was great. But that's as near as anyone my age will ever get. So I'll take that. But yeah, it would have been great to see Freddie. I mean, you can only imagine what that would have been like. I'll have to pick Steve's brain about it. But yeah, what an amazing guy, and just. Again, it's all about opinions, but you know.
I don't know. I mean, three for three, we all agree he's the best. I mean, there's no better. Yeah. I mean, his voice is unrivaled. I mean, I like a lot, and you know, I like a lot of singers. There's a lot of really good singers out there, but there's just something that Freddie did that nobody comes close to. I mean, I just can't understand it. And maybe it is, Dave, like you said. You know, it's because he's such a great performer too. But it doesn't matter. You just hear his voice, even on this song that I don't like very much. It's like, God damn, he's so good. He's so good. Yeah.
The only, when I've gone through this thought experiment in the past, and I don't agree with his political opinions of late, but I think Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden actually is someone in it, you know, someone who you could say, you know, amazing vocalist and amazing frontman as well. Obviously, the music is not as much in the zeitgeist, so it's a bit more niche. But yeah, I'd say Bruce Dickinson's the only other person who I've thought in the past that, okay, yeah, he's still not anywhere near Freddie, but, you know, he's somewhere, he's at least in the ballpark, whereas most other people aren't.
Yeah. I think for me, it's the versatility of you could sing anything. I mean, just in the context of this album, there's heavy metal on this album. There's, you know, the song we just talked about, One Year of Love, is anything but he could sing any style you wanted, which it's upon the strength of Queen, I suppose, was their musical diversity. They straddled so many genres, all out rock, bordering into heavy metal at times, pop, funk, jazz, if you will, you know, acoustic ballads, everything really. And you know, his voice just fit everything that was ever presented to him. He just, you know, amazing. And I suppose, you know, it's such a shame that we'll never know what else they would, you know. He was 45 when he passed, so there was still so much road ahead of him as a performer. And you know, you wonder if he was still alive, he'd be sort of 77, 78 now, and would he, this people that age still out there doing it? And
still
doing
be
it
quite, rocking it out.
Exactly. You know, would he still be doing it? What would he be like now as a performer and as a singer? You know, you can't imagine the voice at 70, late 70s would be like it was here at 39, 40. I mean, that's just life. That's nature. But it would have been really interesting to see what else, you know, would have come from him over the years. It's such a shame we never got that. But yeah, that's 1 year of love. So the next song, a very divisive little number. This one isn't in Highlander and probably make Highlanders all the better for it. A Mercury / Deacon composition at 4 minutes and 21 seconds. This is Pain Is So Close to Pleasure, which should sound like it should be something from Hellraiser, you know, Pain Is So Close to Pleasure. But this is anything but. I can see Tony's rocking out to it there. So I guess I will start again with Tony. Tony,
I love
talk,
it.
Talk to me.
I love this song, you guys. Hey. It's not my favorite song on the album, but I love it. This is Freddie and John's love letter to Smokey Robinson. This is a Motown fucking classic. And I'm sorry, if you had the Four Tops singing this song, if you had Smokey and the Miracles, if you had, you know, when Lionel Richie, young Lionel Richie, you know, like, I'm sorry. This song would be a big fucking hit if it were like, if they had put this out 20 years sooner, 1966 Motown number. And I know that's not who they are, but that's what I love about it. I like Motown music and I just totally feel that that's what this is. It had no business being in Highlander. I don't know why it's on this record. It is a joy. I think they're having a ton of fun and I really like it. So I'm going to let you guys, I will stop there so you can shit all over it.
Dave, I will let you go first.
Yeah, I hate this song. It's terrible for me. I mean, it's so cheesy. It feels like it should be on Heidi High or something like that. Just some holiday camp nonsense. And then, you know, you've got all the redcoats in the back. You know, they're giving all of the synchronized clicking and everything. And it just, the keyboards as well, they just sound they don't sound like a professional band. It sounds like, you know, someone who's just busking or something like that, you know, or down at the local working men's club. I really hate this song.
Well, it's fair. Like that scene in The Commitments, and fucking and.
Yeah.
That's who they are, right?
Okay. I mean, I get, Tony, I get what you're saying about the Motown. I've actually written in my notes here, I can't stand it. This is like a pound shop Motown song. Yeah, I mean, what I will good say about it, again, Freddie's falsetto is superb in this song. I mean, he's singing way up there in like a really high-pitched, but it sounds flawless, beautiful, clear vocals. Again, I'm repeating myself here by saying how great his singing is throughout, but again, it's, you know, he's elevating what is a very poor song, in my opinion, very forgettable, and he's, you know, giving it something by singing something different to the way he sings on the rest of the album. So for that, I applaud it. But I mean, quite a few John Deacon songs that he had a hand in writing have this kind of vibe to them. He didn't write heavy songs or, you know, rockers as such. He wrote these kind of Motown-y, R&B-ish kind of songs. But yeah, it's not great. I mean,
it's not great. It's fun. It's not great. It's fun. I like it for what you're right. You were both. It's not great, Max. I totally agree. It's not great.
Yeah.
It's fun. I have a fun time with it.
Yeah, yeah. It was released as a single, not in this country, but it was released as a single in Holland and did quite well in the Dutch charts, apparently.
Amazing.
It must have appealed to the Dutch sensibility or something. It must have been smoking a lot of fucking weed when when this song the song was out. Yes, maybe you'd have to get into it. But yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to shit on it too much because I don't like shit on Queen. You know, I hold them up on a pedestal. But when they're at their worst, they are as bad as anybody. When they're at the best, they're beyond anybody. But when they're at the worst, they are as bad as anybody. But this isn't quite them at their worst, but it is getting there, in my humble opinion. So that's Pain Is So Close to Pleasure. I found it more painful than pleasurable.
And the song lyric is from the previous song, too.
Yeah, we didn't mention that, did
oh,
we?
Oh, yeah, you just mentioned, yeah, 1 year of love, yeah.
Yeah, well, that'll come up later on side two of the record, where I'll hold it, where there's like, wait, how is it Brian May is solely credited for writing this song and Freddie Mercury is solely credited for writing this song, but that's clearly that exact same riff from that song. I'm sorry. And then in this one too, right, like One Year of Love is slowly written by Deacon, and it says Pain is So Close to Pleasure is solely written lyrics by Freddie. So did Freddie like, I love that lyric, I'm going to turn it into a song? Or so it's hard to know. I mean, it is a collaborative process on how they decided who gets the song credit, writing credit. But yeah, it's just a weird thing. And they're put together back to back on the album as though they're building on each other.
Yeah.
Strange.
It's like a musical coupling, if you will. A musical odyssey. They should have put it together as one 8.5 minute song.
And put it on a Foo Fighters album.
I'd rather listen to that than One by One by the Foo Fighters ever again.
Without a doubt. All day long. Yes.
Jesus wept. Okay. Well, that was Pain is So Close to Pleasure. What a beautiful ditty. And speaking of ditties, this is another Mercury Deacon composition. Two in a row, you lucky people out there. This is Friends Will Be Friends. Yes. Lovely stuff. Dave, what do you think to Friends Will Be Friends?
I do love this song. It's not my favorite off the album, but again, it just has that big Queen chorus vocal, doesn't it? You know, and it's so distinctive. You've got Freddie's vocals there, but you got the other guys backing him up as well. And it's just such a wholesome message as well, isn't it? I would say I'm less about the lyrics and more about the music, but with this one, you just can't help but feel good and kind of warm inside, all about, you know, friends will be friends right to the end. So, I think when I came back and I saw this was on the album, I think I liked it more in the past. I don't quite know what's happened to me. Maybe I'm more cynical in my old age, but I remember really loving this song back in the day. But I feel like it's not done any favors with the song that comes after it, because I love that one a lot more. So this one almost by association gets compared in my own head with the next song. So I'm like, oh yeah, it's maybe not quite as good as I remember it. But no, I wouldn't say this, if you were to ask, you know, what is the thing? We asked 100 people on the audience, what is that? I can't think what the game show is now.
Family Fortunes.
Family Fortunes, that's the one. So I don't think this one would make it in the top 10 Queen songs. You know, there's a lot more that would come before this. But for me, it is an iconic song of theirs as well. So, yeah, it's back to a bit of form after that abomination that came before.
Fair enough. Wow. Tony, do you like Friends Will Be Friends?
I do like Friends Will Be Friends because it is like Freddie had some notes left over from Play the Game and was like, I will play this song. And I love Play the Game. And again, that's my favorite Queen album is The Game. And so this is like a continuation of that. I like when Freddie plays piano. I like Freddie's voice. I like this song. And I'm with you. See, I'm the opposite, though, Dave. Like when I was younger, I thought the song was fine. It was fine. And then, you know, you lose Freddie, and then you think about when this song was written and what they were going through as people, as a band, him, you know, with his diagnosis and everything. And before that became public and everything. So like, to me, this is that, this is the song about them. Like you said, the positive message. So I actually have kind of, I still would like Play the Game better than this song, but like, I feel like that just because overall, I think that's a tighter song. But I think there's as I've gotten older and just kind of thought about the meaning of the song more and when it was written, I think it just gets me in the heart a little bit more, where you've gotten more cynical, Dave. I've gotten more soft to this song. So Max can break the tie, I guess. Maybe Max is right in the middle. Maybe Max is the Goldilocks on this one, and it'll be just right.
I'm kind of neither one thing nor the other with Friends Will Be Friends. I think it's trying to be like one of those huge Queen anthems that they'd written before, like We Are the Champions or something like that, but it doesn't quite get there in a sense. It's again, the message is really nice, but a bit like One Vision, it's delivered in such a ham-fisted way, it almost drips with insincerity, even though it's not insincere. It kind of sounds insincere because of the way it's delivered. I mean, it's not an unpleasant song. I can enjoy it as such. It's, you know, it's 4 minutes in and out. the opening does sound a bit like Bergerac as well. It was an old TV show in the UK in the 80s called Bergerac, about a police detective on the island of Jersey. Yeah. And there's just a certain bit of that theme song that just sounds a little bit like it here and there. But yeah, I mean, again, it's a nice song. The sentiment's real. The sentiment's nice. It just comes across as a real sort of, I don't want to say fake, because that's not fair, but it sounds a little bit contrived. But yeah, I mean, again, you can't knock it. Again, it's more memorable than most bands could ever write. So you gotta be, you know, fair to them in that way. Again, great singing. The band sound really tight as well. It's quite understated. So yeah, I do like it. I just don't love it, but you know, I'll give it what props. That's end side one of the album, if you're talking in a traditional vinyl sense. And now we're into the home straight with these four songs, which are all very much featured in Highlander in differing degrees of success. But this one, probably one of Queen's most famous songs, actually, solely composed by Brian May and sung by Brian May at the start there, as you can hear some lead vocals from Brian there just a little bit. This is Who Wants to Live Forever. Which is, you know, one of Queen's most famous and many people's favourite songs. Dave, what do you reckon to Who Wants to Live Forever?
Absolutely love it. Just cannot say a bad thing about this. I think I think if I think about my favourite Queen songs, I probably don't think of this one first. I mean, I've got to go with the crowd and say probably Bohemian Rhapsody. And again, a lot of those sort of 70s anthems, if you like, you know, Flash, or Flash was 80, I guess, wasn't it? Fat Bottom Girls, Crazy Little Thing Called Love. There are so many of those earlier songs that I just absolutely love. But this one is, it gets you right in the feels, doesn't it? And I remember it was through Highlander that I heard this for the first time. And it was a coming together of understanding and being truly bought into the film as well. And I think even as a kid, I mean, a kid, but you're becoming more self-aware of things. And, you know, you just, I remember thinking, oh, it'd be great to live forever, wouldn't it? You know, just see all the things that happen in the future, and, you know, it'd be fantastic. And it was Highlander that taught me that, oh, shit, that'd be terrible. So when Hannah? I think it was Hannah, wasn't it?
Heather.
Heather, sorry. Yeah. Heather. So it's horrendous, the fact that, you know, he's not got a day older since he got sort of killed on the battlefield, and she's grown to be an old lady and dies of natural causes. And it just hit me. It's like, holy shit, that'd be like the worst thing, to just watch everyone you love around you just die constantly. And it must harden you, because you wouldn't want to get close to anyone, because you know how it's going to end. And I just remember having all of these feelings, but, you know, listening to it many, many times over the years, again, just everything about it is perfect. Brian May's solo here, it could not be improved upon. Just the feel to every single note, and the choices that he's making when he's sort of playing particular notes, but then when he's bending the strings, I just absolutely love it. I can't say anything where I would think, you know, I'll tweak this or tweak that. Even the synth that I talked about in the, you know, a lot of the rest of the album, obviously synth appears on here, but it seems to fit much better here. It's not the over-the-top 80s synth. It's a more kind of somber, atmospheric synth. So, yeah, absolutely love this one.
Yeah. What do you reckon, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, Dave said it all. In the film, when you see Heather dying and it starts, it's actually Freddie singing the opening line. And wow, it's, you know, you don't ever want to say less Freddie. I do feel like having it as a duet on the album, I do. It's different. But different in a good way. Do you know what I mean? Like hearing Freddie sing it the whole time is fine. Hearing Brett, because Brian will Brian's voice features again in a couple of songs. And we know that as the opening of a different song that I think Max doesn't love as much. No, I think it's beautiful. And rewatching the Highlander series recently in a row, which I'd never done before, they use it. They come, you know, because the opening theme, which we'll get to that later too, but they will bring other Queen songs in. And so this, when things are tough, when things are getting you in the heart, they'll play this. And it just, and I think honestly in the film Bohemian Rhapsody, the way that they used it in that film changed it again. It's in the moment when Freddie tells the band that he's sick and then they play Who Wants to Live Forever. You're like, son of a bitch, gonna lose it. So I just think it's such a beautiful song. If Brian May only ever wrote one song and it was this, he would be proud forever. You know what I mean? Like Brian May's written a million bangers, but he wrote this, and it's just, I get goosebumps thinking about it. You hear it. It's perfect. It's a perfect song. And poor John Deacon didn't get to play on it. I'm sure that's the reason he quit. He went into hiding like, you bastards, you took me off of Who Wants to Live Forever. I'm going to replace you with a saxophone on this other janky song, Brian. Take that.
He doesn't seem the type as well. Like, was it Def Leppard where the bass player and the drummer used to go underneath the stage with the groupies when the lead singer and guitarist were doing that kind of bit on their own? No. They were like, brilliant, we're off now.
Yeah, right. No, that's true. Yeah, no, I love it. I just love it, Max. It's a great song. I'm sure you'll say, we'll be surprised, Dave. Maybe Max will be like, it's jank. I can't imagine he will.
No. I think this is, as a composer, I think this is Brian May's finest hour. Like you said, Tony, he's written so many massive songs for Queen over their 20-something years as a working band. But I think this is his crowning glory. In every way, shape, form, I think it's a perfect song. Every bit of it just works. Even Brian's vocals as well. He sings the opening section, then he sings a mid-section as well. I mean, people sometimes don't like Brian's vocals, but I think he has a nice voice. I think he has a really nice warmth to his voice. That's the thing with Queen. Brian and Roger were also great vocalists in their own right. Obviously, they're not Freddie. No one's Freddie. But there's a lead vocalist. They were really good. So you'd get songs here and there through their catalogue where Brian and Roger would sing lead passages. And when it works, it works. And I think Brian sounds really good. You know, it's obviously hugely significant in Highlander film. And like you said, Tony, I think it's in about 6 episodes as well. They really did use it quite liberally in the TV show. You can't help but be stirred by the emotion of it. The orchestration is beautiful in it as well. It fits really well. As Queen do have a tendency to sometimes overdo it. But I think here it just lies on the correct end of being subtle as opposed to being like really too much, too kitchen sink. But yeah, I think it's, as songs go, it's beautiful. And I think it's aged really well for us, for an album that's nearly 38 years old. It doesn't sound that dated as opposed to some of the other material that we've talked about on this song, a song we're going to talk about in a couple of songs' time. But yeah, I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful song. There's no getting away from it. I think, again, if this comes on and you're like, oh, I fucking hate this song, then again, you've got to have some issues. You know, you've got more issues than a newsagent's if you don't like this song or find some value in it, some kind of human emotion. I just think it's beautifully written, beautifully, beautifully written. And the message is really good as well. You know, what is the point of living forever? There is no benefit to it, really, you know, in terms of what you'll lose along the way and what you'll have to leave behind. So, yeah, I totally do love this song. But we go from... Yeah.
Thank you for that, Max. That was lovely. Yeah. I just loved it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, we go from a song of utter beauty to a song of something else, also composed by Brian May. After such a beautiful, lush song, this is Brian, you know, doing his heavy stuff. You know, Brian did like to bring the heaviness to Queen. This is Gimme the Prize, brackets, Kurgan's theme. Which, for again, film fans, this is what's played when we first meet Kurgan in the modern day setting, when he puts his cassette in his car. And in fact, you can even hear the dialogue from it now. And this song is liberally peppered with dialogue from the film, which is just wonderful. Whether the song is or not remains to be seen. Tony, talk to me about Gimme the Prize, Kurgan's theme. Do you like it?
Again, because it's so ingrained into what the movie is. and because they decide to use Clancy Brown, who is the star. I mean, it's Lambert's movie, and I know, you know, what Connery showed up for $3 million for 6 days of work or whatever. But I'm telling you, Clancy Brown is the goddamn star of this movie. Like, he is so amazing. And this song, and again, this was one of those ones that kind of came together. Queen was only going to do one or two songs for the movie, but they saw the 30-minute rough cut or whatever, and they went and wrote all these songs. And this is one of those ones, and Brian just kills it. Like, Clancy, this song looks like it was written for Clancy Brown. And I know he had to come in and, like, re-record some of the stuff from the movie for the, you know, they didn't pull it straight from the thing, so it sounded good, even though, you know, it's produced to make it look like that. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a lot of fun. The part that will come up again later in Princess of the Universe, there's, like, that opening riff was great, but there's the wow, and it's like whatever May is doing there with his whammy bar and just the way that he's pressing on you, it feels like, you know, you're being chased by the Kurgan, and like he's relentless. And so I do enjoy it. It's not the greatest song on here, but it is so integral to the plot of the movie. And again, I feel like this is Queen making Highlander better by doing this song. And they're like, oh shit, now we better up our game. Clancy, Queen wrote you a song. And it's not like, you know, Clancy Brown was always worried about how gross the Kurgan was. You know, he leaned in because he's a pro. But I feel like when Queen writes you a song, you got to give him what for. So I love it. I know Russell Mulcahy openly hates this song, but I don't understand why. Dude, you created this character that they wrote this song for. So crazy.
Fair enough. Dave, what do you reckon to give me the prize?
It's one that I'd never heard before. And obviously, it's one of those movie songs, isn't it? So you've got all of the samples throughout the song. And, you know, the Kurgan, we heard a little bit at the start there. I know his name. You know, it's so ominous. What strikes me is this, I think, would be amazing live. You know, if you were in a stadium or even if you were in a smaller venue, you could really rock out to this one, couldn't you? Obviously, you wouldn't have Clancy Brown in the corner as the Kurgan, but, you know, you'd have to make do without that. So I actually don't mind this song. And it's interesting to hear Freddie just go for this rock tune. You know, straight off the bat, he's properly given a more aggressive vocal. And, you know, we obviously know his powerful vocals that he can belt out. But this is a different... There's a slightly more shouty quality to how he delivers this. So I actually don't mind this song. I think it's, I mean, the second half here is why I think, well, why didn't you just have a Highlander soundtrack? I don't quite get it. But yeah, I think definitely not the best, probably in the bottom half of the songs on this album. However, I actually quite like it.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for it, but I think it's because of what it represents from the film and the great bits of dialogue from the film, and you can't help but listen to it, you know, especially at the end where it all breaks down, and at the very end as it's starting to fade out, you hear, there can be only one. I mean, it is great. I mean, but the song itself isn't great, just judged in isolation. Apparently John Deacon and Freddie Mercury both hated this.
Right.
But I suppose, you know... You've got to be a pro, aren't you? Freddie certainly sings his heart out on this song. You know, I suppose that's democracy of being in a band. You know, you've got to give and take and give your all for songs that perhaps you don't particularly care for. But I mean, the opening section of the song is really excellent stuff, where you get that diddly, like the really sort of like whiddly, and then it kicks in with the heaviness. But it doesn't really live up to it as it goes on. It kind of just degenerates into like a really weird midsection of like just off kilter rhythm with the sound of sword fighting in there and, you know, bits of dialogue thrown in. It's like, for me, it kind of sounds like half a song, like an idea he had kicking around where they thought, we'll use that and we'll, you know, we'll incorporate all the bits from the film that, rather than really honing and refining the song itself. But I mean, it's okay to listen to. You know, the guitar works really good. You can't fault it. You know, it's Brian May at the end of the day. When Brian May plays, you can't help but enjoy it. But it just kind of sounded like a filler song. But at the same time, when you're watching it in the film, it's great when you see Kurgan driving along through the street, the night streets of New York, when you've met him at the start of the film in the flashbacks. But here you're getting to see him, you know, in his punk rocker get up, you know, looking like, you know, evil incarnate, one of the scariest movie villains ever. Just brilliant. So, yeah, for that point of view, it'll always get a special place in my heart. But just listening to the song in isolation and judging it purely on its own merits, it ain't necessarily the greatest song ever written, but, you know, whatever. I suppose, you know, you can't have it all.
I think without all of the movie samples in it, it's half the song again. I mean, the intro, I think that kind of guitar riff, not the noodling bit at the start, but the when you get into the verse, I think it's powerful on its own, but it doesn't really go anywhere. I think that the enjoyment I get out of it is just hearing all the different little Kurgan bits and stuff. So I agree. That doesn't make it a great song. If it's the reason you like it is because it reminds you of the movie, but yeah, not too bad.
No. Well, we go from not too bad to what, in my opinion, is an absolute stinker of a song. That's just my opinion. I'll be keen to hear yours in a moment. This is one of Roger's compositions again, not quite on the same level as his composition of Kind of Magic. This is Don't Lose Your Head. I nearly lost something listening to this song. It wasn't my head. Maybe The Will to Live, I'm not sure. But yeah, this is Don't Lose Your Head. Dave, what do you reckon to Don't Lose Your Head?
I mean, I would put it somewhere with Vanilla Ice's Ninja Rap, I think. From the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. Oh, this is horrendous. I mean, this is an experimental song, I guess, isn't it? Where they're playing about with kind of samples and stuff. And I don't think, you know, anyone really nailed that until later in the 80s and getting into the 90s. So I can see what they're trying to do, but just on no level do I enjoy this song. I don't enjoy that synth sound that I think it's really jarring. It hurts my ears. It's unimaginative, you know. It's kind of repetitive, which again, you know, the kind of repetitive dance music, I can get behind that. I understand why that's kind of addictive almost, you know, and people like that. But yeah, this just misses the mark massively for me. And even though you do, again, you get the Kurgan's sound samples in there, it's not enough to rescue this film, this track.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page, but I'll keep my powder dry till we've heard from Tony. Tony, what do you think? Don't Lose Your Head.
Yeah, I mean, I still like it slightly better than When You're of Love. And I know When You're of Love is a better song, like sonically, it's a better song. There's the woman singing the backing vocals in this.
Yeah, Joan Armatrading.
Yeah. She's amazing. And she pulls it out of the ditch for me a little. Her voice is glorious. And when the backup singer is the best part of the song. You know what you said, Dave, and it occurred to me, and I didn't think of it until you just said it. There was a band, have you ever heard of the band called The Art of Noise?
They did a Kiss with Tom Jones, yeah?
Yeah. Yes, they did.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they did the Noise version of Peter Gunn. The Peter Gunn theme song. That's what this, as soon as you started saying it's an experimental song, that's what they did. They played with that, so they were called The Art of Noise. That opening sound where it sounds like Roger is playing garbage cans. It's like, so it's not a great song. Again, if it weren't on this soundtrack, if it weren't in the movie the way that it was, I do like all of that. I think it belongs in the movie. It doesn't belong on a soundtrack. And I feel like this goes back to the question you keep asking, Dave, is why didn't they make a soundtrack? Because it wasn't until, like, if you made a soundtrack, you had to have like the other music. Like the reason that Prince had to do his own Batman soundtrack, because there's the Denny Elfman score and then the Prince score, soundtrack. So I feel like at the time, if you made a soundtrack, and we talked about it on Discord with Flash, is mostly score, right? There's not a full set of Flash songs from Queen. So I feel like that was their experience writing soundtracks. And so this is one of those things that was probably better done as an instrumental And I guess there is an instrumental version, which may be better, maybe not, but it definitely just feels like noise from a score that's just like background, like, you know, the sound effects department on a movie making shit together. So yeah, it's not great. But I do think that the backup singer's voice is great. I think she pairs really nicely with that. So that's me going to be remotely positive. She sounds good with Freddie. She actually sounds like, but she's not one of the backup singers from The Reflex. Duran Duran's The Reflex. But she could be.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this is a, this is a terrible, terrible song. It also got used in one episode of the TV show as well, Tony. But
the one with Joan Jett.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Jesus Christ. I mean, that is barrel scraping of the highest order. Yeah, it's not a good song. I mean, it's so weird. It works just as a little, if they'd just had a 30-second piece of music, and it's played in the film after Brenda gets kidnapped by Kurgan towards the end of the film, just as a little 30-minute snatch of music, that would be absolutely fine. But to somehow stretch out to 4.5 minutes worth, like they do here.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Max, not 30 minutes. Christ.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
I'll be jumping out the window at 30 minutes of this.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I meant 30 seconds. Jesus. 30 minutes of this. My God, I'd be catatonic, I think, if I had to listen to this for that long. But yeah, I mean, they're stretching this musical premise so thin it's about to snap. I mean, there's 2 minutes of meandering in the song as well that have no relation. It just completely bloats the song. And then there's that really weird midsection where he goes on about drink driving or something, and he goes, "Don't drink drive," and he goes, "Don't get breathalyzed." Like, what is that? What even is that? Like, what is that in relation to this song in the context of the movie? Like, don't drink drive, don't get breathalyzed.
Great, maybe it was a bit from Grange Hill. You know, they had the "Just Say No." No,
well,
you know, it's one of those after school, you know, yeah. Not infomercials. What's the right word? Where they're trying to warn
the
kids.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. Yeah, we used to get them a lot. Like, how to cross the road and don't talk to strangers and all.
Charlie says, don't pick up fireworks or something.
Don't go climbing pylons, kids. And all
I remember that.
Don't go sitting on railway tracks. Yeah, really not a good idea. But do you know what? I'd rather sit on a railway track at commuter hour than have to listen to this again. It really is a poor song. I just don't know what they're trying to do here musically. Again, Freddie sings really well. John Armitage, Jane's little bit where she's like, "Don't lose your head. Don't lose your head." She says here and there, that's kind of weird, but it gives it a bit of character, a bit of flavor, I suppose. But it is just so throwaway and one of probably, in my mind anyway, one of the worst songs in the Queen catalog. Just that keyboard sound, it's I suppose it is what it is, actually. It sounds so 80s action film score, it's untrue. That you know, it won't be out of place in a Schwarzenegger movie or something like that. It's, you know, it just sound a bit commando-ish.
Oh, commando!
There is a Freddie. Oh, there's a Freddie Mercury lookalike at the end of Commando. I see how you've tied it all together.
There you go. You see, yeah, Bennett. Yeah.
Stick around.
Yeah, don't need a gun, John. Don't need a gun. Shoot you in the balls, John. I would rather listen to Bennett than another dose of "Don't Lose Your Head." That was "Don't Lose Your Head." But in my opinion, we've saved the best to last. This is, for me, this last song here is the highlight of the album. This is, in my opinion, one of the highlights of the Queen catalogue. Never mind this album, it is one of my all-time favourite songs. The theme of Highlander, a Freddie Mercury composition, Princess of the Universe. Absolute musical majesty. Tony, I already know what you're going to say, but talk to me about Princess of the Universe.
I fucking love this song so much. So this is the problem, though. Dave, leave this right there. That is from... I'm sorry... I don't understand. That is from "Give Me the Prize." That exact line, that exact sound. It's a little bit, it's a different, but like, I love this song so much. You know how like when you're watching a TV show, when sometimes you're like, you get that option to skip the credits,
Yeah.
If you're watching Highlander, you don't skip the credits because you know why? This fucking song plays.
Yeah.
And it's so good. My favorite thing that happened, though, I didn't know as I was rewatching the Highlander series, there's actually a moment in the show where Duncan's driving around and this song is on the radio. Like, I'm like, meta. Oh my God, that is super amazing. No, I love everything about it. The video is perfect. Freddie fighting Christopher Lambert with his microphone stand. And then, you know, Brian May dressed like Connor with his flying V. I love this song. It's so good. And again, this song is so good, it made them think they needed more Highlander stuff. The song is so good that they were like, huh, Freddie Mercury in 4.5 minutes made a whole mythology. I guess we should investigate that for 20 more years and keep fucking up the original movie over and over. Yeah. What if there's a source? No. What if there's not? What if the source? What if you get to the source and it's just Freddie Mercury saying, go back in time and stop this. Go back to Planet Zeist. I love this song. It's perfect. It is glorious. It is a top 10. I mean, my favorite Queen song is Fat Bottom Girls, but this is a top 10 Queen song of all time. I love it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Dave, what do you reckon to Princes of the Universe?
Yeah, I think it's a good, solid song. I probably like it a bit less than you guys. I mean, it definitely hits you at the start of Highlander, doesn't it? And it just, again, it's that opening note that Freddie blasts out, you know, the here. And it's so fat, the whole sound, it is great. I mean, I'm not sure about, you know, Brian May dressing up as Connor McLeod, to be honest, because I do feel like it doesn't date well, that outfit, the kind of flasher Mac and the white trainers. I just think he does look
classic.
Like a...
Classic McLeod. he just looks like the most rumpled hero in the world. Yeah,
I'd love a coat like that.
I was going to say, if you're going on a cosplay or something, just don't walk past any schools, or you might find yourself in the back of a police van. But yeah, I do think it's a really great anthem, isn't it? You know, great big fat vocals. You know, that classic sort of Queen sound with everyone sort of joining in. And I like the way it kind of drops off as well. You know, it drops off, so you've just got Freddie's vocal and the bass drum, you know, dum, 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 before everyone comes back in again. So, yeah, great song. But for me, there are other better songs on this album. But, you know, it does, again, it is a bit odd. And I can't let go of the whole soundtrack thing. And you're right, it's probably just more about contractual getting agreements with everyone. But because it starts at the start of Highlander and it finishes this album, it messes with my head a little bit. But in terms of a song on its own, you know, it almost seems too strong to finish an album with. So, yeah, we sometimes theorize about how you would reorder. I haven't necessarily thought about how I would reorder, but I probably wouldn't have this one at the end. I would probably start this album off with this song, to be honest. But yeah, really, really good track.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I love this song. I absolutely adore this song. I mean, it is part of the most brilliant opening of a film ever. You get the Canon Films logo. Then you get a monologue spoken by the great Sir Sean Connery. Then
he recorded in a bathroom.
And it sounds like it too, but whatever. And then you get this fucking song, and if all that went enough, then you get some WWE wrestling as well, and then you get a sword fight where someone's head gets cut off, and that's the opening 5 minutes. You get all that. So
yeah, the old guy doing needless backflips
for zeal. Yeah, yeah, that bear no sort of resemblance to the geography of the room.
Or
the human
Connor's
being.
Just away, isn't he? He's just doing backflips.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? what is that made of?
As you do, you know, stay here and fight. But I mean, yeah, it is one of my all-time favorite Queen songs. It's heavy as hell, which is for a Freddie Mercury composition as well. Very few songs written just by Freddie were this heavy. And it is probably one of Queen's heaviest numbers, actually, in their whole catalog. I love the fast section in the middle where it breaks down and he's like, born to be kings. And it goes really fast for about a minute and a half. That is ace. Then it just goes into this whole guitar noodle, which is the scene in the video where Brian May is atop the steps, the very same steps where Kurgan takes Ramirez's head. It's just brilliant. It's just got a huge sound. You know, my son Oliver, this is one of his favorite songs. It has been since he was about 5 years old. Obviously, I've let him watch Highlander, you know, that's, we'll save that for another few years yet. But he just loves this song, and he loves the video as well.
I mean, the video. We probably watched it a similar age. I mean, I'm not saying it's right.
Oh, absolutely. This came out. I mean, I was 13 when it came out, so I absolutely watched it right away. But yeah. I saw a lot worse and a lot younger. You're a good parent, Max. You're not like our parents. Good job.
I know. I watched it when I was about 8 years old on an old VHS 100%. That had been just left in the lounge, and there was no one else there. So I just put it on and watched Highlander. You know, brilliant. You know, people's getting the head cuts off, boobs, everything. An 8 year old boy wants to watch.
What more do you want? Villain. Bit of Queen soundtrack.
The Queen soundtrack, honestly, and Clancy Brown's Kurgan is the great. I mean, top 10 movie villain.
Oh, without question.
I almost, without thinking about it too deeply, I think he'd be pushing top 5.
You're probably right.
I think he's that good.
He is. He really is. He is the standout character in the film. You know, he's absolutely amazing. We'll save that film conversation for another day. But yeah. I mean, this song is, it just has everything. Never released a single in this country. That video for the single was only released in the US. Wasn't released as a single in this country.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome, world.
I know.
I love that video. And it's like when. Because Lambert is so wooden, and you know he's blind, right? He's legally, so there's that moment where he's got to swing his sword at Freddy, and it's so slow, and you don't realize that, you don't know that in the moment. You're like, "What the fuck are we doing?" Like the sword fight, Freddy sword fighting with Connor. I'm here for that, but then it's like cling, and then you only learn later. You're like, "Oh, Christopher Lambert! All of the people who had to sword fight with Christopher Lambert were risking themselves because he needed glasses, but he didn't wear them because apparently you can't, you know, be an action star and wear glasses, I guess, or fucking contacts. So yeah, I was like, that's terrifying. He's swinging a sword at Fred Mercury.
Yeah, notice it's just the one exchange.
It's
isn't
just
it?
One.
And then he goes, and then he disappears. Yeah, never to be seen again. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think the insurance in that video would have been like, if you chop the lead singer of Queen's head off, you're done, mate. You are finished in show business, Christoph. You're done. So yeah, I think it was a case of just lightly
tap.
His microphone stand with your sword, and then go, and then just walk off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just I love this song. You'd have to be somewhat dead inside to not. At least enjoy it and find some, just it stirs you up. And obviously, if you're a fan of Highlander and the Highlander franchise, I mean, this song is, it's just, it goes hand in hand with it. It was, you know, as well as being the theme to this, it's used at the beginning of every single episode of the TV show. I think every single one, anyway. You'll know, Tony, you've just rewatched the entire
119 episodes. I never skipped the intro.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. And it's also as well the worst cover version of a song ever. In this song in Highlander 5, another band or artist covers it. I don't know who it is, I'll have to look it up, but it is the worst cover version of a song I think I've ever heard.
Ever
heard in my life.
It's trash. It is so it's just like I mean like the movie So Bad, like if you put a Queen song in the middle of the movie though, everybody would be like, "Oh, what, this is too good for this garbage."
Yeah. It is. Yeah. But in my opinion, I think anyway, it is a great song, a great way to wrap up the album. I mean, like, I agree with Dave, it should have been the opener. What a 100%. Great way. What a great way. They could have even put the Connery monologue at the top for it. Maybe, you know, maybe it would have cost too much. Connery didn't come cheap in those days. I mean, he got $1 million for, you know, a handful of days work, which was a lot of money in 1985. So yeah, but I absolutely adore this song. It's just the highlight of the album for me. And that is the album. That is all 9 tracks. That is the end of A Kind of Magic. Whether it was A Kind of Magic for you, who only knows, but we'll find out in a minute what you guys thought. So we'll start with Dave. Dave, what are you going to give this album? I'll just briefly as well recap. It's been a while since I've done this. So these are the five ranges we offer to album. If it's the greatest album you've ever heard, nigh on perfect, it goes to Paradise City. If it's just below perfect, like it's a really, really good album, but just not quite perfection, it's Dr. Feelgood. If it's a middle of the road album, it's, you know, it's good, it's enjoyable, it's fun to listen to, but not a classic, it's Crossroads. If it kind of sucks and isn't the greatest thing you've ever heard, it goes to Skid Row. And if it's a fucking abomination of an album, an absolute atrocity in the world of music, then it goes down to Hotel California. So, Dave, what are you going to give this one?
So this is a real tough one to score. Obviously, it will be for the three of us, I'm sure, because it's so lumpy. You know, you've got some absolutely great tracks on there, or for me at least, you know, the Who Wants to Live Forever stands out for me as the one track that I put there, and definitely top three Queen songs, but almost top, let's say top 20 songs ever. You know, and I just think, as I say, the more I've listened to the album over this last month, I can't find fault with anything about it at all. The way it's produced, you know, all the instrumental parts, the vocals, just so, so good. The opening two tracks, I'd said, you know, they're decent. They're good pop rock kind of dad rock sound songs that have just been played so much on commercial TV and stuff. I'm a bit fatigued by those. And then there are some absolute shockers on here as well. So I think I'm gonna stay on the fence, really. I'm gonna go right in the middle and say it's a Crossroads. I have thought a little bit about Skid Row, but I can't really put Freddie down there, even though some of these songs belong even lower than that. But yeah, Crossroads for me.
Fair enough. I can't argue with any of that. Tony, what are you giving it?
Well, I hear everything that Dave said, and I was trying to like do some data analytics in my brain was out taking a walk this morning. I'm like, okay, so is the greatness outdo some of the jank? Like, so if you were to go, like, how many of these songs, standalone songs, do I put in Paradise City? Four 5-star songs on this album. Great, that's almost half, right? Like, there's only 9 songs, and then there's a couple of fours. There's a 1-3, and there's a couple of twos. I don't even the two that are really not great, When You're of Love and Don't Lose Your Head. We still wouldn't even put the, and I know not a 30-minute version of Don't Lose Your Head, but there's still something to be salvaged there. So like, as I was weighing all that out, like, I think the good is so good that Who Wants to Live Forever and Princes of the Universe are so good, are so absurdly good that they're like a 6. Right. I mean, so to me, I have to put the whole album, not even in between the whole album, Dr. Feelgood. It's just because the two best songs are beyond 5 to me. Like, in a million years, like you said, greatest songs of all time. Like, it to me, like, Who Wants to Live Forever is up there with, like, you know, George Harrison's My Sweet Lord. Like, it's so good. It's so good. I can't believe that somebody wrote it. Like, there's songs that are like that. They're like, holy shit. How did your brain do this? This is, everybody else should quit writing songs because they didn't write this. That's how good. So to me, that elevates it. Plus Highlander. So that's me. What say you, Max?
Very similar. Very, very similar, actually, to what you've just said, Tony, is what I was going to say. You can't put it in Paradise City because it's not, it has too many songs in it that suck, quite frankly. But when it's good, it's as good as it gets. But when it's bad, it's as bad as it gets. And somewhere in the middle you meet. I could never put it in Crossroads because I feel it is better than a Crossroads album. So I have to put it in Dr. Feelgood. I think the moments that stand tall in this album are songs that I've loved all my life. So there'll always be songs that hold a very special place in my heart. The songs I don't like on this album, Don't Lose Your Head, Pain Is a Cost of Pleasure, stinkers, absolute stinkers. I can't stand them at all. But like I said earlier in the show, you know, when Queen were bad, they were really bad. But when they were good, they were absolutely superhuman. So I think this album, it isn't the best album in the Queen catalog. It's not even close. I think there's 3, 4, or maybe even 5 albums that Queen did that top this one quite easily. But not why I picked it. I picked it because I wanted to talk about this particular you know, time capsule and have some fun with the shittier moments and, you know, enjoy the great moments. So yeah, only just it makes it into Dr. Feelgood for me. Yeah. So I think that's two Dr. Feelgoods and one Crossroads, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. It's pretty good. That's solid. Yeah. Solid for Queen. Dave's pulling up the data.
So what that means with two Dr. Feelgoods and a Crossroads, that puts A Kind of Magic in the number 10 spot, joint with All Killer No Filler. So just behind Siamese Dream, which we discussed before, Number of the Beast and Porno Graffiti. Just after those. And after that, you've got Physical Graffiti by Led Zeppelin and Misplaced Childhood by Marillion in 12th and 13th.
Yeah.
So we are building up a real pantheon here.
Yeah, Appetite for Destruction. I don't know what's... I mean, 2 5s and a 4.5. I honestly don't know. I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see as we move through the list here. Yeah. Well, my pick is next, lads.
It is. Tell us.
Dave and I discussed last month was the first time we had a main member of the band not have a dong. It was the first time with Darcy, the bass player. Everything, it's been a bit of a sausage fest. And and again, not to totally be like, yes, that means we're going to listen to Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Maybe another time. But again, the Blackhearts are a bunch of dudes. I've decided to mix it up a little. I mean, one foot in, we'll, instead of like doing the Go-Go's, which I will definitely do one time down the line, we will be listening to 1977's, I'm going to say masterpiece, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. So that is next. So we're going to get a lot of voices.
There
little
we go.
Stevie Nicks. 11 track. It'll be fun. There's a lot to talk about with this album. As I said before, Ken Calais said, the producer of this album, the two people he hated working with the most were Lindsey Buckingham and Paul McCartney.
But got the best results, I'll say.
100%. Because he's like, they're such assholes to work with. And I kept saying, why don't you just produce it yourself? Because they're in their own heads quite a bit. So anyway, so I'm really excited to get to Rumours. Fleetwood Mac is my wife's favorite band. So we are big Mac heads over here. I love them. So yeah, 1977, I was 4. Max, you were born?
No, I was 2 years after this, 79.
Okay, so Dave, you were just born.
I was 1, yeah, in 77.
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right, nice. Well, this will be fun. So I can't wait to do it. So we'll get a month of the Mac, and then we'll come together and talk about Mick Fleetwood's balls.
Yeah, we can't talk about Return of the Mac. That's a different conversation. So,
yeah.
That's the common cloud. Dodgy Mac.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, you know, we could talk about Dodgy Macs and, you know, flashers all night, but we're going to have to call it a night. Guys, it's been an absolute honor to chat with you again to discuss such an amazing album, a classic album, or not, as the case may be. You know, somewhere in between, I think tonight's one has been. But I think where we go with the next episode, I think it's quite universally going to be accepted as something very special. Well, I know it will be on my point of view. So I look forward to that. It's been awesome. So thank you very much, guys. It's been great to have you guys on again and to speak to you guys. It's always a treat, and I look forward to this every month. And I look forward to us doing some Rumours next time.
Bye. Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah.
Bye now.
So we'll see you all again out there. Bye-bye. See you later. Bye.